At the 25th anniversary of the conclusion of the Vietnam War, Maynard Forbes is interviewed by Renee Gerlich for Concord's oral history program on his perspectives and experiences in that war, in which he was a career military officer. The interview is taking place on November 28, 2000. Mr. Forbes is 63 years old. You had already been in the military for 10 years by the time the Vietnam War had heated up. You had gone in 1958.
Right, 1958 was the year I graduated from college, got commissioned, and went into the service in December of 1958 at Fort Dodge.
In the early part of the 1960s, under John F. Kennedy's administration, the support for the war was on a very minimal basis in Vietnam and the that whole Southeast Asia area?
Well, it was strictly on an advisor basis, and advisors and special forces units that went in to work with the local military people. At this point they were all over Southeast Asia, primarily in Vietnam, but they were in Laos and Cambodia at the same time. There wasn't a lot of publicity about it in this country. I remember in the middle 60s, early 60s, while I was in Germany, getting classified traffic looking for volunteers to go as advisors and the like to work to Vietnam.
At that time, the idea as the country got more and more into involvement there was containment, the fear of communism spreading.
Yep, that's correct. And I think that the idea of the advisors was to make a stronger military force within the country and hopefully to ward off any of the theoretical spread of communism in Southeast Asia. In 1965, we put actual American units in. I think it was the 173rd Airborne Brigade was the first unit in the early part of 1965. From there, the number of troops and the acknowledged presence of troops started to build.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of the domino effect that Vietnam was very crucial.
Oh, I think that was what was being used as the as the reason for being there, and if you allow the party line thought from our side as opposed to the communist side, but that was what was being pushed, that as the countries down there went, it would soon be down into Indonesia and off into Thailand and across to India. We're looking at stopping it there and making sure that it wouldn't spread.
As a professional military career person, what was your assignment there?
Well, in the first time I went to Vietnam, I went in June of 1968. I was a major at the time. My specialty was field artillery. I was given the task of developing a tactical operations center, the artillery side of a tactical operations center, around the Benoit Air Base in the city of Benoit, which was east of Saigon. Saigon had developed a center similar to this probably 6 months before, not quite that, just shortly after the Tet Offensive. My responsibility was to establish a set of towers where personnel in the evening hours used scopes and to spot rocket flashes or mortar flashes. We had a radio network that we were able to call in artillery fire from a number of different units around the Benoit area, and we were in touch with the gunship helicopters so that we could call in them if there was a need for it. We also had the requirement for clearing artillery fires. All the artillery fire that was conducted within the area had to be cleared through us to make sure that it was going into an area that was not a built-up area or an area where there were friendly forces. That was about a six-month assignment.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned the statistic that by 1968, 550,000 American soldiers were there.
I think that was a figure that was being used. The majority of them at that time were in American divisional and brigade-sized units, plus all of the support force that went to making these units able to exist. There was the big Cameron Bay facility. Long been covered acres and acres of land that was all support people, to include hospitals and supply areas. So, yeah, 550, I think, was the figure that was generally accepted as that. And that was throughout the country.
Did you interact much with the Vietnamese people?
On that tour, I did not. The advisor people on the ground, and there were still a lot, and their numbers were increasing, were the ones that dealt directly with the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. My task was to deal with American units and coordinate the movement of artillery units. After the job as the head of the Tactical Operations Center, I became the operations officer for a field artillery group, which had four artillery battalions. And they were scattered over the eastern half of the Three Corps area, which included the Benoit Air Base and all of Saigon. Mm-hmm. Uchi and up into the corner near Cambodia, even speak.
Yet you found the Viet Cong in a conversation. You said they were industrious and ingenious.
Well,
and they were
that,
native.
Well, yes, but that observation was came about in my second tour when I was an advisor, and my experience directly with them was after the ceasefire in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they were if the question was about what we knew of them while we were in the American units. Yes, mm-hmm. they made use of every little thing, the watches to set off the rockets, and they'd be 10 miles away by the time the rockets went off in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And they were set by a watch, which was powered by batteries that some GI probably threw away.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, yeah, you could say they were industrious. To live in caves and tunnels and the rest, long periods of time, they had to be somewhat industrious.
At this time, 1968, the United States people here are very divided over the war. How did that impact you?
Read the articles, I'd listen to whatever was going on. I think that at that point I was a career military officer with the thinking that the side that was putting the people into Vietnam and the rest of it was probably somewhat correct, and that was the job I was given, and that's within reason was what I ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Not follow it right straight down into the ground, but there were directors and the rest that we followed and conducted a mission.
Also, here you are in this remote part of the world, and you have a family, four children,
mm-hmm.
back home. How did that?
Understanding that nobody wants to go over and stick his head in front of a rifle bullet or a hand grenade or whatever, I obviously tried to follow safe and secure procedures, but there were often times where you had to be where you had to be, and in order to be able to see, do, and conduct whatever business you had to do. Yes, I thought about the family, thought about all of it, but some things that have to be done.
Because I asked the question because this is also a guerrilla type of war where you don't always know who the enemy is, and could you comment on that?
Well, that's correct, and I think that in the first tour, while I was dealing with American units, I probably didn't have the exposure out in the countryside. When I would go from the base camp to outlying units, it was normally by air. Yes, there was some danger of getting shot down, but not near as much as in the second tour, folding up and down canals in a little two or three man sampan, or hiking across rice paddies, not knowing who was behind the bushes and the scrub along up in front of it. That time frame was 72, 73. There were nowhere near as many American forces in the country, and there'd been peace talks or attempts at peace talks in Paris for a great long time, so that it probably wasn't quite as dangerous a situation, but there were still lots of mines, lots of bungee sticks, and the rest.
Explain what a bungee pit is.
A bungee pit is a hole dug in the ground that has sharpened bamboo stakes run into the bottom of it, and then it's covered with leaves and brush to make it appear like it's a solid ground, and when the person walks along, he steps through, rams the sharpened bamboo up into his foot.
And the bamboo has
It probably has all kinds of stuff, whatever they could devise,
mm-hmm.
On it to cause infection. And,
and there were also a lot of landmines?
There were landmines. They captured American landmines, they captured grenades, they captured all kinds of munitions, and would booby trap them and use them wherever they could.
In the second tour, you actually learned the language and the customs of the people.
Yeah, since it was 1972 that I learned it, don't ask me any questions on it. But yes, I went to school, combined State Department and Defense Department school. Got an appreciation of the language so that I could go down into the marketplace or talk with the Vietnamese people that I was dealing with in a slow conversation and get the idea of what was going on. I lived right out in the village by road about 40 miles away from my next higher headquarters.
Okay.
There were three of us. I was a senior person. I had a captain and a sergeant who worked for me. And we had a variety of duties of dealing with the people at the district headquarters, which was where we were located, and help them coordinate if they needed military assistance or helicopter assistance. We went along on their military activities to be sure that A, they were conducting them, B, that if they needed extra assistance, we always had a radio, and we could, somebody had a radio, and we had frequencies that we could switch to call in assistance.
Village were you, you were in the Mekong Delta?
I was down in the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
The province headquarters was in the city of Sop Trang, S-O-C, capital T-R-A-N-G, which was south of Can Tho. The village I was in was Ang Hoa, and that was south and west of the province headquarters. It was a little tiny village that was at the intersection of the Grand Canal and several side canals, and it was an industrious little village. There was fishing, and outside there was rice growing. There was a big Buddhist temple out to the west of us that we visited periodically just to see what interaction they seem to be having with the other side. I'm sure that we learned an awful lot, but it's a very interesting place to visit.
Now, you were advising not only our government, but the South Vietnamese government.
Well, I was providing information back to through U.S. channels as to what was going on, how they were conducting their operations, what they needed, if things were in difficulty. There was an aid advisor who was at the province headquarters who periodically came out and dealt on the civilian side of it for aid assistance to certain parts of the village. They their primary means of transportation was either walking on the small trails that led down along the canals, or on a sampan, which was a little low, long, narrow canoe-type vehicle with a motor on it. For the most part, there were motors with a long drive shaft because the canals were shallow.
You found the government corrupt.
Oh, I think that at that point. In order to get anything done, it cost you a fixed fee plus a hidden fee for doing just about anything.
So graft was rampant. Very inefficient government then.
Lots of things got siphoned off here and there. One of the best examples was concrete. The infrastructure people came to build a rebuild a reinforced spot for the two 105 howitzers that were in the district village headquarters. And they poured their concrete and went away and were very happy, and only to find out that they'd only used about a third of the concrete that was necessary. It was mostly sand, and the first time they fired the guns, the parapet crumbled. So somebody was using concrete for some other purpose. Whatever it was, I don't know, but I don't know that we ever found out. So they dug in.
Early in 1973 was the time of the peace talks.
Well, the ceasefire was the last part of January in 1973, signed in Paris. And at that point, there were very few American units, and they all left during the period of time that the end of January to the end of March. What were left as far as American forces there were some of the advisors who were divided up into military regions, which were a little different than the divisions that we had used militarily. And the idea was that there would be peace talks at all levels, at the village level, at the district level, at the province level, and at the country level. And what our task was during this two-month period was to establish meeting areas where these conferences, peace talks, could take place. We worked and got schools and public buildings and whatever set aside, and the appropriate tables, and in the case of the district headquarters and the province headquarters, microphones. They didn't do that down at the village level. The only actual talking that was done in country was in Saigon, and that happened late in March. And I'm not sure that there was an awful lot of concrete agreement between the four parties at that time. Four parties being the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, the Vietnamese, and the U.S. And each of these four groups were to be represented equally at the table. Most of the discussion was on the size of the table, the shape of the table, the number of people who could sit directly at the table, and the number of people who could sit behind the people who were sitting directly at the table.
Were you part of it?
I was not part of the discussion. My job was in dealing with establishing the areas, helping people find the buildings, the material that it took to put together the rooms in which all of this was taking place. We worked out of an operations center in Canto, and we, for the most part, flew to different locations in the Delta. On the 31st of March, everybody left the country. Everybody except a very small nucleus was left in Saigon, and those people left on the skids of the helicopters in April of 1975. But during this 2 month period was the time when the repatriation of the prisoners of war took place. There were several plane loads that came into Saigon. Senator McCain was one of the people on this in this group that came back at that time.
He was in
Hanoi, and he came back to Saigon and then off to the hospitals.
This is a war that came in to people's living rooms nightly. Very different than anything previous. The immediacy almost of the communication.
Well, I think that the communications are what provided the country with the information to fuel the division. There were hawks and doves, if you will, and it depended on which side you happened to be on. You could pick out or glean out of the 6 o'clock news anything you wanted to glean. I'm sure that some of the reports were slanted to make everything look a little bit better than, in some cases, than maybe it was. I think that has come out in literature over the course of the last 25 years. McNamara's book and the rest would seem to lead you to understand that the body counts and the rest were sometimes a little bit fictitious.
Well, I for one thought that we were winning.
Well, I think that if you took the view from the reports as you went along, until we came to the Tet Offensive in '68, we seemed to be doing very well. That was a slap in the face, and it was a pretty rough time. The swing of the pendulum came back during '68 and '69. As we had the major buildup of forces, I think we found, we got sidetracked with Milai and several other incidents. And, probably it was a wonder that there weren't more.
The Tet Offensive came from North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was all over the country, but mm-hmm. primarily up north. But there was a big push in Saigon. It was countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
There were stronger pushes up north than it was in Saigon, but they were. They were going for bear at that particular time.
So the North Vietnamese at that point become a presence throughout the country.
Yes, a vanishing presence. They were here, they were there,
mm-hmm.
They supported the local Viet Cong during that time also. It was just a major push.
Did you feel, after April 75, that's when the North Vietnamese also mounted another strong offensive. And so Saigon falls. Did you feel that you were constrained from using the amount of military force that was necessary to win?
Oh, I think that the rules of engagement were such that U.S. units were constrained to an extent from using the weapons that may have provided a tactical advantage, a strategic advantage of not knowing who you were fighting, finding units who were camped on top of great cave and tunnel encampments of the North Vietnamese, and which today is a tourist area in Vietnam. You know, not knowing who you were dealing with was the probably the biggest problem.
The terrain, the climate, everything is very different.
Well, in the southern part of the country, it's a warm, it's a hot, wet, or a hot, dry season. But as you get, and you've got some terrain situations that are not apparent down in the southern part of the country. I mean, the French found that at Dien Bien Phu, which is up in the, was in North Vietnam, back in '54. They were in valleys and being annihilated because they were using unsound tactics. But we had some similar problems in the highlands where terrain was a deciding factor. In the Delta, it was a matter of, it was pretty wide open country. You could see for miles.
Mm-hmm.
You get into built up areas along the edges of the canals, and there was opportunity for all kinds of guerrilla warfare.
You were in North Vietnam as well, South Vietnam.
I wasn't even in the north part of South Vietnam. Uh-huh. My my time was time was spent in what was considered the three corps and the four corps area of Vietnam, and that was all south. Take a line east and west through Saigon. My area was all 30 miles, a line north of that line, 30 miles, it was, I was always south of that.
Mm-hmm. You leave in March of 73?
I left, the end of March of 73.
Mm-hmm. The war changes a great deal, influences the presidency. Johnson in 68 doesn't accept the nomination to go for another term. Big contrast in 64 when he was so popularly elected. The Democratic Convention in 1968 causes a great stir. It's
My experience with the 68 convention is strictly out of the military newspaper in Vietnam, because I was there, I was in Vietnam at the time of the convention.
Mm-hmm.
So I've listened to the reports and looked at the films, the film clips and the rest since then. It obviously was kind of a reaction to what was going on over there, strongest by the forces on the peace side of it, who wanted us to get out.
A lot of violence and unrest. I don't know if that was transmitted,
there was some made of it in the military newspapers over there, but at the time it was not as well publicized there as it was here.
Mm-hmm. With the ending of the war, the veterans return home, and there's very little recognition. But you stay on in the military.
Right. At that point, by 72, I had about 14 years in the service, and I had reasonable marks as for my performance, and felt that I should was going to continue on. I knew at that mm-hmm. point that I was probably going to come back to Concord and become involved in the business where I am now, but there was enough going on in the business to maintain it for a period of time. So yes, I was going to stay. Did stay. And as I came back from Vietnam, I went to...
Came back 73 from Vietnam, and your military career ended in 82.
Mm-hmm. I went from Vietnam to Washington for 3 years, to Korea for a year, and then back to Massachusetts.
Within the military, you do not feel that you're left out the way the veterans returning are left out.
I think that's probably true. I think that there is now, was then, enough camaraderie within the military to deal with discussions of the war and activities in the war and the like. Coming back to the civilian community, you came back to a divided community. Some who felt you were right, some who felt you were wrong, and probably didn't take too long a time to figure out who was who, and neither one of them were going to pat you on the back for your time over there. Probably the advent of the big wall on the down in D.C. Is something that has helped. I think there have been things in the last few years that have made some of the Vietnam veterans feel a little bit more accepted. I have to say that here in Concord that the there is a group of the younger Vietnam vets who now are very prominent in Memorial Day parades, and I think that they are the nucleus that will carry this activity on in the years to come. They're a good group. They are not spit and polish, with one exception, and that one exception is Joe Venti, who is Mr. Spit and Polish, and is a Marine Corps Reserve, and is very, very good in everything he does. Jack Martinson. L. Gordon Robinson is out of town, but still comes to participate. Mm-hmm. Billy Soberg and a number of that group who were mostly Marines. And mm-hmm. It's interesting to see how they have molded together as a group and have been very strong in their support of military activities. They were extremely strong in developing the monuments down on Monument Square in the last year, and it's to their credit that that exists in the, for the memory soldiers in Concord.
Oh, that monument reconstruction project is just very, very moving. You have been marching for quite some time in the Memorial Day Parade.
Yeah, I think that I haven't missed too many of them. I think that one of the people who was a the greatest supporter of the Memorial Day parades was David Little, who in his starched whites of the Navy was there for both Memorial Day and Patriots Day. But his articles in the newspaper were always well-intended and helped to get some of the veterans out on that day. It's this group of young Vietnam vets who will continue this tradition along, and they're the ones who, for the next 10 or 15 years, are going to be the bulk of it.
Thank you.